Hello, friends, and welcome to another episode of Dan and Benny in the Ring. I'm Dan Sebastiano, joined, as always, by the BS Express himself, Benny Scala. Benny, how you doing, buddy?
It's Tuesday night, and we got this thing called Dan and Benny in the Ring. So, yeah, life is good.
Speaking of life being good, how's the dating life treating you?
Well, once again, you think things are going to go well, so I pick up this young lady. We go out to dinner, and start doing the perfunctory, which is my big word of the day, small talk. So I brought up, my shot, my COVID shot. I was trying to explain how, the couple of days after I was not feeling that well. And but I didn't mention COVID. I said I just had my shot, and I was just, kind of feeling mushy and just not myself. And she said, well, after I had my shot, I started scratching behind my left ear. I said, well, I got a COVID shot. What did you get? She said, oh, it was my parvo shot.
Benny, your jokes progressively get more terrible, and I feel bad hearing them. as much as we love the banter, you're always good for a chuckle. Well, we have a kind of a change of pace from some of the more recent shows we've been doing. Benny, why don't you introduce our guest today? We got a author and good mind with us.
This is a multi-talented man. Started out actually writing for wrestling magazines. Has a very diversified background. Then got into writing dystopian science fiction baseball novels of all things, which they're phenomenal too. And also has a show on YouTube called Joyland, which I watched the first episode over the weekend. I really enjoyed it. Also, now he has a new book out called A Fastball for Freedom, and then also a play called A Black and White Cookie. Gary, did I miss anything? This is Mr. Gary Morgenstein.
Thank you for having me on. Thank you. I'm delighted to come in. As we used to say back in the day, into the squared circle.
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir.
Dating myself, yes.
Yeah, well, with the many terms that have been banned and removed from the lexicon, it's nice to hear somebody call it the squared circle. Still can't say belt, but I'll take squared circle.
Can't say wrestler.
Yeah, or strap, or title shot, apparently, anymore. Now it's a title opportunity, or championship opportunity, excuse me. It's not a title.
Can you say rule breaker?
I'm not sure. It was
scientific wrestler and rule breaker.
I did see the one of the pictures from backstage at WrestleMania had Hulk Hogan talking to, I forget who it was in the picture, but behind him was a sign reminding wrestlers not to slap their leg when they do the kicks anymore. So no leg slaps. we were going to, when Benny, introduced the idea of bringing you on and talked about the wrestling magazines and obviously your YouTube show, I was really fascinated by your work on the dystopian science fiction baseball. But before we get to that, you said something just before we went on air about being the mind behind one of the greatest pieces of cinema of the last couple decades. Can you tell us the story of your involvement with Sharknado?
Yes. Well, for many years, I was director of publicity at Sci-Fi Channel. And one of my areas to handle was the B-movies, the Saturday B-movies. Just the real, Mothman and, the really silly ones that were made for like $40. But they were fun because if you love science fiction and you had some humor and you just wanted to kick back, they were a lot of fun. So we got Sharknado on the schedule. And it was, the premise was, as many know, that tornadoes hit Los Angeles, scoop sharks out of the ocean, drop them on shore, and they like eat people and cause havoc. But it almost, I'm doing the publicity for it, but it almost didn't make it on air, which not a lot of people know, because this was supposed to air in July, and in June, tornadoes hit the Midwest and killed a couple of the host of the Discovery Tornado Chase's show. I'm sorry, I don't remember the exact specific name. And so my master said, well, you know, we probably shouldn't show the movie because it will seem like we're being insensitive. I said, why? I said, Sharknado is about a tornadoes hitting Los Angeles, which has never happened in the history of mankind. I mean, maybe during the dinosaurs. No one's going to think right. that. So I was given the riot act. Well, you better, this better not roll back on us or you're in trouble. So that's whenever anyone has said that to me in my life, I think Benny, I have a feeling, shares this thing that only makes me more determined.
Yeah. But thanks for the permission.
That's right. Yeah. Because I'm going to do now what I want. And I got a big story in the Daily News. And I asked the editor, Don Kaplan, TV editor. I said, do you want to see a screener of the movie? He says, no, the title's enough. Okay. That's, I don't need, you know, I have the pictures, the cheesiest pictures in the world, terrible pictures. Now, Ian Ziering, the star, would not do publicity because he thought this would destroy his career, such as his career was at that point anyway. We had Tara Reid, who did a phoner, and some reporters thought that she was a little high. It was like 11 o'clock in the morning. And we had the director, Anthony C. Ferranti. And I got some good stuff going in. And then the night it aired, it blew up the internet. It just, people went crazy about the title. And suddenly Mia Farrow is tweeting with Philip Roth and the American Red Cross is posting what to do if a Sharknado hits. And I don't go to sleep that late. So I got up the next morning. I went to see a friend. I think Benny and I have to talk about dating back in the days between my marriage. Because we could talk. I have sympathy for you, my friend. But anyway, so I went to this woman who I was seeing. And because I needed to borrow a suitcase because I was going to Comic-Con. And she says, oh, you know, your movie Sharknado is on the Today Show. I said, what? She said, yeah, they're doing a second episode, a second segment. I said, what are you talking about? I got to work that day. My phone pretty much glowed red with all the people all over the country, all over the world. Call me, you know, ABC Evening News and just the BBC. Everyone, I could barely go pee. And my favorite part of that was Nightline call. And they said, well, we want to interview the cast. And I said, wait a second. There was just a military coup in Egypt. Don't you want to cover that? They said, no, we want to cover Sharknado. And we were off to the races. It was the craziest, wildest few years. I was in cameos in Sharknado 2, Sharknado 3. And my favorite Sharknado was the one, Sharknado 2, was set in New York. And it just had the most soul. By Sharknado 3, everyone was doing cameos, and they kind of killed it. Such, you know, as possible. But Sharknado 2 is actually a fun movie. And one of the episodes, there was a scene set, it was originally set at Yankee Stadium, but the Yankees refused to let us destroy Yankee Stadium, even with CGI. They would, you know, had it up their butts, okay?
Right.
So the Mets said, sure, destroy Citi Field. We don't care. You know, that's fine with us. So we get to Citi Field.
Nothing else is happening there anyway.
Exactly. It was in those days. Now, the scene is supposed to be set in the summer. And because of scheduling delays and this and that, and we didn't start filming in New York until February. And, you know, New York in February can be a little chilly. So we get to Citi Field. It's snowing. It's 15 degrees. All these poor extras were told to show up in shorts.
Oh, no.
And T-shirts. And people are like turning blue in the stands. They put all the heaters in there. So I said, well, this is easy to spin. We'll just say that because the Sharknado hit, it turned summer into winter. That makes sense, right? I mean, it was perfect sense.
But
everyone glommed about it. And Matt Lauer, they all like were crazy about it. All the stars wanted to be in Sharknado. It was pretty exciting. And then there were simulcasts all over the world. How is this even possible?
That's incredible. Now, let me ask you something. As you talked about working publicity and all.
Yeah.
There's always, Benny and I, we've had guests on, and you hear the story about somebody that books something or organizes something, and there's always that one person who nobody believed or kind of, you know, gets the I told you so moment. Was there a moment where you just knew or somebody seemed to know, like, this is going to be as huge as it was, or did it catch everybody off guard?
It caught a lot of people off guard. And because they, all around sci-fi, they had always made fun of the movies because it was beneath them. It was not, you know, the high-priced original programming from Los Angeles. Right. So when I would talk about movies at meetings, people would like, you know, smirk at me and like laugh at me. It's always a nice thing when you're sitting in a meeting and people are laughing at you because, you know, the show that you're doing, because you're doing your job, you're doing the publicity. But it was kind of like people sort of apologized to me when this hit. Well, Gary, I guess you were right about this. And then, but of course, no one would, after that, you know, after like 24 hours, everyone, you know, what was it? John Kennedy said, victory has 1,000 fathers, but defeat is an orphan. So yeah. Everyone, we had 1,000 fathers, right? Of people claiming credit and everyone jumped on the bandwagon. But it was a lot of fun. It was just crazy stuff.
You know, it's funny, too, as the sequels went on and more big name actors and big name celebrities with cameos. And and it was great to see something. I mean, this in the best way, something silly that became so big. But Benny, you were talking about the books earlier. Yeah, you're up next. We got a question for Gary.
Yeah, I'm going to actually bring it back and into wrestling. And this is a question I think we've asked every single guest. And I'll never stop asking this question because everybody has had a great answer. Never the same. And when did the wrestling bug bite you? Give me a year. How did it happen? You know, when did you go to your first show? Who was your hero growing up? You know, was it, you know, back in the Ray Morgan era of Capitol Wrestling? Did it go before that?
Oh, it was Bruno Sammartino. I was, you know, I was not as big a wrestling fan until I started writing back in 78. I joined GC London Publishing. But it was Bruno always, I always loved Bruno because he had class. And there was this quiet dignity about him. And that's what always struck me. That always won me over. And when I joined the wrestling magazines back in 78, I was a journalist. I had just come back from Cincinnati where I'd worked for the Cincinnati Post. I made the mistake of following a girl and that didn't work out as it often doesn't. And I came back and I needed a job and I answered an ad in Newsday for the to work for a wrestling magazine. And I had no idea what I was doing. So they gave us a writing test. So I had to write a story about Fritz von Erich. And nice. I guess it was good. Yeah. I guess it was good enough because except the one thing I mentioned, I made up his age. They said, no. We never talk about the writer's age. Because remember, this is in the days before Vince Jr. So this was the old school wrestling where you had, you know, the kayfabe. No one talked. Mil Mascaris came to the office once for lunch and insisted, we took him to a restaurant nearby, and he insisted on wearing his mask. Mm-hmm. And we said, you know, it's kind of like this burly guy, you know, wearing a mask, people are going to look at you. He says, no, if I take off my mask, someone will recognize me. And it was always, they were always in character, which was just one of the fascinating things about it. And then and I worked with great, you know, Bill Apner, of course, I worked with, and Stu Sachs, Peter King, Michael Cape, Randy Gordon, Steve Farhood, who's, you know, became a Hall of Fame boxing writer and an analyst for Showtime. But we had a great time. We were all guys in our 20s, or, you know, Bill was like 30, a little older. And we would just, we would put the first person who came into the office, the new guy, we'd torture him and fake some rivalry in the office and set up a fake fight. That was the initiation. And we just had fun because we all loved what we were doing. And that was, it was just so much fun to work in. And Bill was our emissary. He was the public face. He was the photographer. And he went to the matches. And he was the one who interacted. And I mean, my job, I was the main writer. For 3.5 years, I was on the founding writers and editors of PWI in September 1979. So we would make up the stories. So, and it worked by first we got the photo. So say we would get a photo of from Japan, and it would be Andre the Giant, okay? And Andre the Giant is, you know, he looks upset or whatever, he lost or something. So we would come up with a headline, The Secret Turmoil of Andre the Giant. So then I would go back to my desk and write 3 pages describing the secret turmoil of Andre the Giant. And as long as I didn't break the story that was being going on in the ring, and a rule, I didn't make a rule breaker a good guy. I know those are terms, which, you know, I you know, those days are gone, but that's all right. You know, it's the history. Everything accepted it. I mean, Bruno got upset once because we wrote something about his sister and the Nazis and during World War II. One of our writers got a little carried away, and so we got in a little trouble. But for the most part, I was struck when I first started there that it was the only place where you could call someone a son of a bitch in print, and they would call and thank you on the phone. Because it, you know, was all publicity. And also remember, this was pre-cable days, okay? This was obviously pre-internet. So we were the sole, really the sole reliable source for information about wrestling for the wrestling fans. You could not turn on the Superstation to see what was happening in Atlanta. You were not getting matches from Florida if you lived in New York. You know, you didn't know what was happening with NWA. So just think about how much people relied on us, the wrestling fans. And on newsstands, we would outsell Sports Illustrated. So it was the golden age of wrestling magazines.
I you know, when you said pretty much the sole source of information for a wrestling fan. And I remember the first magazine I bought was Wrestling World, I think, a Wrestling Review in 1968. And, you know, I had just gotten a black and white TV set for Christmas, and I stumbled upon Lucha Libre, which, you know, was from the National Arena, Capitol Wrestling, on Saturday nights at 6:30 on Channel 47, WNJU, from Newark.
WNJU.
Right. And then I went to my first show in April, and I was hooked by then. I saw Bruno versus Toru Tanaka at the Island Gardens in West Hempstead. And so the next month was my friend, my next door neighbor's birthday. And we were going to, my mom actually let me ditch school, which was amazing. And we took a trip to the Huntington Mall. We took a bus. And so I had stashed away some money doing odd jobs and stuff like that. Get to the mall, thinking like, man, I can buy all these different things at the mall. First place we stop, you know, there's a magazine stand, like right, literally 10 feet from when you get to the mall. I see this aisle, this Wrestling World, Wrestling Review, The Wrestler, Inside Wrestling.
Yeah.
My money was gone in like 3 minutes.
Yeah.
And I mean, for years and years, I was hooked on those magazines.
Yes.
And I really appreciate it, because I always wondered, you know, as I got a little bit older, it's like, how come they never mention, like they always say a reporter. They never say who the reporter is. They just say a reporter. But, you know, I always wondered, how did they come up with this stuff? And now you shed light on it. So thank you for that.
Oh, sure. Well, and I was also, we also had a fictional reporter, this crotchety old drunk journalist, Matt Brock. So I was also Matt Brock.
Okay.
So I was Gary. Or Morgie, as I was my nickname back then, and I was Matt Brock. And we just leaned into it. You know, there were boundaries, but not quite. And, you know, when you're in your 20s, you have a different worldview. You know, we would have wrestling bouts. Whoever had, you know, the office wrestling belt.
It was the cowbell championship, championship office wrestling.
Yes. Yep. Yeah. We would play, what was it? Was it, what was the baseball board game? I think Strat-O-Matic.
Yes.
Yeah. We had teams. We just had fun, you know, we just goofed on each other. It was just a good time. And the publisher, Stanley Weston, God rest his soul, he was also the editor of The Ring. So, you know, I also did some boxing. Worked for some boxing magazines as well, and we felt we were journalists. In fact, I did a story. This is about, I watched Willie Klaus. There's a welterweight fight, a welterweight and middleweight fight at the Feld Forum, and Willie Klausen got killed. I mean, we died in the ring. Okay, and it was in the 10th round. He came back with his hands by his side, and the ref didn't stop the fight. It was bang, 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 and I was just horrified. And To the credit, the publisher let me write an article about, okay, what happens when you get hit in the head? And what you know, people need to know what these boxers are going through, which was kind of a brave thing for a boxing magazine to let one of its reporters turn the light on it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, your brain goes, ba-bing, ba-bing, ba-bing. The brain should not be going bouncing back and forth. That's, you know, you so look, Muhammad Ali is one of the great and sad examples of too many punches to the head.
The one extra fight.
The wrestling, to kind of roll back, got some attention recently. Well, I guess months back now, but John Oliver did an entire expose on his show about the WWE and how they, you know, the early deaths of former wrestlers. And one of the things they talked about was the big lawsuit. And I don't know if either of you heard, it's Tuesday and when we're recording this, but the Supreme Court just said they're not going to hear the appeal on it. So the, a lot of old wrestlers are whether we're in the same boat as boxers and football players and others saying that, you know, somebody had basically arguing that somebody had to have known the damage this was causing and they didn't tell us, or they didn't give us the help we needed when we needed it. And it's kind of sad to think about. And I know I'm not trying to transition, but it really leads to kind of a dark thought. And I want to go to, I hate to say, a lighter note because it's dystopian themed, but Benny mentioned the book series you have, which it was described as dystopian science fiction robot baseball. And the tagline in The Fastball for Freedom, the book Benny mentioned, is 1984 meets Shoeless Joe.
Yeah.
I have to know, we talked about Sharknado and you know, we got to the realism of your magazine writing. Where do you, what is the moment where it clicks that dystopian robot baseball? Like, how does that come about?
You know, the mental illness known as creativity is very unusual. And you really, you know, you really don't know what it happens or how it comes about.
Oh, I was going to say, I apologize. I said robots in relation to my next question. I meant dystopian science fiction baseball. I apologize for the description.
No problem. No, I mean, there are robots in there.
Right.
This was some years ago. A Mound Over Hell came out in 2018. The Fastball for Freedom just came out last month. It's book two. And actually, the idea popped into my head. Oh, geez, it must be 2016. And my wife and I were, it was Sunday, we were listening to the Beatles and having everything bagels with a schmear. And the idea just popped into my head. What about a failed America, a dystopian America, where baseball is facing its last season ever and is ruled by someone named Grandma? And I thought, okay, well, that's, you know, a good two sentences now. I need to flesh this out a little bit. And it just, it was, I wanted to set it in a world where America has failed, but America has failed because of America, not some ecological destruction or aliens or, a plague. Actually, I wrote both novels before the pandemic. And it's because we failed democracy and we failed our freedom and we lost World War III to the Islamic Empire. I mean, think about ISIS controlling the world. And so post-capitalism, post-democracy, it's run by an entity called the family, which is based on the notion that the most important thing is love and friendships and family. But there are things like this would not be allowed because all social media is banned under the anti-narcissism laws. There's no entertainment. Lawyers, bankers, under the anti-parasite laws. Patriotism is banned because baseball is considered equivalent to the old America, the America of the great power, the richest, most powerful nation on earth, which people felt led us into disaster. And so there's one ballpark left. It's Amazon Stadium. It's set in the Bronx, so you can guess which stadium it used to be. And in book one, Mickey Mantle and Ty Cobb come back, and baseball has a renaissance. And the characters are eventually pawns between people who want World War IV and people who want peace. And so in book two of Fastball for Freedom, the main character, Puppy Nidic, has escaped to the Caliphate of London. So I open it up and show America, and I show Islam, and I show what life is like there. And so it's dystopian. You know, you have to write dystopian, but you have to give hope.
Mm-hmm.
And I, in all my writing, I believe that people have to somehow come together. And you have to show in these books that just ordinary people swept up in extraordinary times. And the things that divide us are sometimes very real. But the things that unite us as people are often more real. And so I try to show people trying to find a way to find peace. And it's probably going to be baseball and faith, which does it.
I can understand that. Well, let me ask a more serious toned question. You mentioned about 2016, you said, when the idea came up, and yes. You wrote about how long did it take you to, before I get to the question, about how long did it take you to write the story?
About was a year it, and a half.
Okay, so you were pushing 2018 by the time you finished.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I guess the serious question with the strike system that no pun intended that former Secretary of Defense Mattis ran, and recent success with I believe at the last update before he left off he resigned was more than 90% of all ISIS combatants had been killed or captured. But obviously with the pandemic and other things, the boogeyman of Islamic terrorism is not as prevalent as it was, say, 4 years ago. Given modern times, would you have changed the narrative, or do you see nothing like? Go ahead.
No, I'm sorry. When I talk about ISIS, I'm talking about a radical version. So Iran's around, Turkey's around, and you could go on and on. I thought, okay, America's going to, in the book, America's going to lose World War III. We're not going to lose to the Russians because that's been done, that's boring. Back to Red Door. Okay, we can lose to the Chinese, but that's boring. But Islam is a third rail in the war between the West and Islam. And it goes back, more than 1,000 years. In America, the first foreign war we ever fought was with the Barbary Pirates. Mm-hmm. The Thomas Jefferson.
Yeah, the shores of Tripoli,
right,
from
right.
The.
There you go. Thank you. That's right. Yep. Yes. So, wait. I'm just moving away from my cat. He wants the couch now.
we know who's going to win that one.
Right.
Yeah, you know it. No. Yeah, I'm going to lose that one. So I wanted to show a complete culture shock and a complete divergence about people who really should not look like they can get together and live together. And that was my thinking. And, you'd be pretty, when you write speculative fiction, you have to be both historian and science fiction writer, because you have to look ahead and create a new world. And I do. But then you have to show the reader the plausibility of how that happens. And I'm careful not to date myself. There's no mention ever of contemporary politicians of any stripes.
Right.
There's no mention of any contemporary baseball players except Mike Trout, because I think if he doesn't go to the Hall of Fame, something's very wrong.
Yeah.
But, I don't talk about Hall of Famer Aaron Judge, because I don't think that's ever going to happen. Although, a few years ago, you would have thought, as Benny and I, as Yankee fans, would attest. But you have to show the strands, and you have to there's nothing preordained about being free. Simple as that. There's nothing that says America or any country is always going to be a democracy. Where's that written? The laws are there, but unless the people maintain it, it's not going to stay that way. There's nothing that's preordained about history. I mean, if the Germans don't stop the Panzers at Dunkirk, for whatever the reason, no one still knows why Hitler did it. The expeditionary force could have been wiped out, and Germany could very well have won World War II, or at least forced England to sue for peace. It's the small little things in history that change. Mm-hmm. And empires come and go, and America could just as easily fall to lesser status, and I wanted to explore that on the psyche and what it would be like to be an American like that, and how to start all over again, and what's going to save us. And at the end of the day, it's going to be baseball. It's going to be something as shamelessly sentimental as baseball, which is no longer American national pastime. We know that it's managing to alienate its base now, which is pretty remarkable. It's because It's not a sport. It is in a society that doesn't respect patience. You need patience. You need to find the appeal of baseball. You need to say, oh, so they're moving the center fielder over in left center. Isn't that interesting? It's the quiet aspect of baseball. And that's our country doesn't like that because it doesn't, you know, doesn't conform to tweets. And I think, and that baseball is fading. And there's a reason why baseball is rarely in science fiction, because most people don't think it's going to make the cut.
Yeah, it's interesting because as a nerd, one of the things that have always interested me is in Star Trek, especially focused, it's referenced a few times in The Next Generation, but especially focused on in Deep Space Nine, is the fact that baseball didn't survive to the future. And to go random side note, there's actually a reference where they're talking with its spirit, for lack of a better description, of an old baseball player, Buck Bakai, who was in the Star Trek universe the best baseball player ever. And he talked about how in the very last World Series game he played in, there was like 500 people in the stands, and yes, the world just decided they didn't have time for baseball anymore. It was boring. We moved on to bigger and more exciting things. I just find that fascinating that you're right to think about it now in science fiction, that it's always some form of football, roller derby, monster, robot fights, giant mechs, some kind of combat sport. You never see baseball in the future. That's crazy. Benny, I see you chomping at the bit here. What do you got?
I'm chomping at that bit. So I'm going to be the bizarro Lance Storm and not be serious here for a moment. So,
no, not you, Benny. No, I'm shocked.
So, no, and I'm amazed by this, Gary. You actually tried out for the Yankees.
I did. Back in 1983, once upon a time, I had dark hair. And my second novel was called The Man Who Wanted to Play Center Field for the New York Yankees. It was kind of a baseball Rocky. And this was in the days when the Yankees, many teams, in fact, had open tryouts between 18, I think it was 18 and 29. You could just show up. And the odds were infinitesimal that anyone would ever get signed. But just but in my novel, the main character does that, Danny Newman. And so I had to brainstorm. I called the Yankees and I said, I want to promote my novel. And this, this is simpler times. And I got Murray Cook, the assistant general manager, sweet guy. And I didn't have to do a whole song and dance. I told him what I wanted. I wanted to get publicity for my novel. Could I try out? He says, okay, sure. Just don't get hurt. And I said, I hadn't really thought about getting hurt. Thanks for putting that, in there. And so it was all gone. And I was terrible because I couldn't hit a curveball when I was 12. It wasn't going to get better.
Right.
I prayed to God the night before. I said, look, the Mick is not using his talent anymore. Can you just lend it to me just for an hour? just let me, one shot. That's all, please. And no, he was too busy with something else. So I went to Yankee Stadium, and I swung and missed at the batting machine, the pitching machine. But I stood at Yankee Stadium with a bat in my hand, and I was in center field. And they hit line singles into right field when I moved over, and I hit the cutoff man, and that was amazing. This is the old Yankee Stadium, by the way. I was there walking with the Mick and DiMaggio and Ruth, and it's just. That's the baseball, and that's what baseball has that other sports don't. It's that connection to the past. And maybe you guys know, but who remembers or cares who has the most passing yardage for any quarterback in history? Can you name the number? Does the number have real significance? Bobby Bonds, Babe Ruth, Cy Young, 50. I'm saying the numbers have a different significance because it does connect directly to the past, unlike the other sports. Mm-hmm. Because baseball has not changed as much. And the players are bigger, but it's still a very simple game. And that's where baseball is separate. And I think it's separate from this society as society moves on.
You know, that's when you, I was just, you know, basking in nostalgia when you said that, because you're so right. I know that, I believe Tom Brady has the record now for the most passing yards. It might be Drew Brees. It's one of them, but I couldn't tell you how many. It was like, you know, it's like 75,000 or yeah, something like right, that. You know, and I believe Brady's got the record for TD passes now. But, you know, with baseball, you know that Walter Johnson threw 110 shutouts. You know that Babe Ruth was 94-46 as a pitcher, and he hit 714 home runs. You know that Aaron hit, you know, 755, Bonds hit 762. You know all those things. You know Cy Young won, 512 games? Grover Cleveland won 373. 511. Grover Cleveland won 373 games.
Yes.
There's no other sport where even the most passionate fan could recite those kind of things about their players.
Yeah.
So that is just so true.
Yeah. It's interesting to think, because you're right, and it is Drew Brees, by the way, with the most passing yards. But you think about, okay, football, you hear like the immaculate reception or the catch or, you know, the miracle at the Meadowlands. They have these moments. But it's not the same as, like you said, you know, 762 or Ripken 2131. You know, the moments that any baseball fan, you're not an Orioles fan, you know 2131. I'm not a Yankees fan, I know Babe Ruth. Like, you know, you've got these moments that baseball has, and it also has that connection that it's one of those sports that you can be terrible at. Everybody, you and your buddies go to the Sandlot, and everybody's terrible, and you still have a great time.
Yes.
If everybody's terrible at football, you can't have fun, because you can't throw a pass, you can't catch a ball. You know, baseball, okay, you swing and a miss, everybody's still having a good time. It's ingrained as a kid. It's those things that you always enjoy, and you play catch with your dad, and the hot dogs. Yeah. And I love that narrative that Benny was painting, which brings me back to it that you mentioned about, you know, the future and wanting to view that. And I'm curious of how you got in the mindset. You explained the narrative of the world, but how you got in the mindset to visualize something you love so much dying.
Well, that's hard, but as a writer, you have to take the hit. You know, you have to write things which you find unpleasant. Your characters will behave in ways you disapprove of. I mean, that's just the process. That's because I'm not writing for me. The writers are, you know, you're very, you know, very schizo. Because on the one hand, you think you're God. You're writing this incredible thing that everyone cares about. You know, your words. On the other hand, oh, maybe it sucks. You know, that's, you know, the neurotic. But it's up to you guys and everyone out there listening to decide, to draw your conclusions about what I've written. It's your story. Once I finish it, once the book's done, it's not me. There's no right. Oh, did I think this happened? Is that right? No, there's no right or wrong. It's how you feel. And that's the beauty of it, is to reach people, the magic to reach people. I mean, I'm friends with Benny through my writing. You know, that's kind of special. That's wonderful. I reach someone I've never met, but now we're friends through my words. And that's a beautiful thing to touch people like that. And especially when you could do with something that you love so much, baseball. You know, I grew up six blocks from Yankee Stadium.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up in the Bronx. So but it hurts sometimes when I wrote baseball. It seems about the book opens, the first one, A Mound Over Hell, opens on the final opening day, 2098. And there's like 15, 16 people in the stands, and that most of them are probably sleeping or making out. And and baseball, Yankees, Amazon, Yankees, was Yankee Stadium. And it was the scene of a terrorist attack in the 2065 World Series, the seventh game. And baseball was punished because baseball was associated with the rebels who wanted World War III more vigorously prosecuted. And they tried to take out the government at the time, and they failed. And they paid the price for it. So all the ballparks were burnt to the ground. The Hall of Fame was burnt to the ground. Owning a baseball glove was considered treason. But Amazon Stadium was kept alive as a monument to that sedition to that treason, excuse me, and sedition. So there are, you know, skeletons in the stands. There's parts where there's mortar shells, open, you know, holes in the scoreboard. It's very dystopian. And mm-hmm. but then it somehow changes. Because in the books, baseball touches people again. It's a curiosity, but there's something deep within them that says, oh, wait, baseball. Yeah, cool. And they have to learn how to be fans again, because this is a very polite country now. Everyone is very nice to each other. There's almost no crime. So you can't start yelling. You have, you know, you just sit there with the fans. In the beginning, was just sitting there quietly, not applauding. It's like,
right. Oh,
you know, guy, you're allowed to yell. Well, but that's not polite. Well, no, but, you know.
You almost get that visual of the old black and white reels, Babe yeah. Ruth and all, where everybody in the stands is in a suit and tie. And it's,
yes.
you know, even huge moments, it's like, you know, golf claps, you know, it was very, very much it was like going to the theater.
Yep. Yeah. Well, in book two, in A Fastball for Freedom, is finally in 2099 is the first full major league season since 2065. And robots rebuilt all the stadiums per the original specifications. So it's the old Yankee Stadium. It's the old Fenway Park.
Right.
You know, and the names are not like, you know, these ridiculous names anymore. Progressive Field. I mean, what is that? It's a municipal stadium. Come on, give me a break. You know, it's Forbes Field. It's Riverfront. It's Crosley Field.
Right.
So it goes back. And then in book three, which I'm writing, A Dugout to Peace, it's going to go back even more. But as Puppy is in England, in the Islamic Empire, he forms the Caliphate Baseball Association because he wants to use baseball as some way to bring people together. It doesn't work. So he has so Muslims play POWs, American POWs, who have been abandoned by their country and left to languish in prisoner of war camps in mm-hmm. England. And they're like in their 60s, but they're full of vim and vigor, and they're out for revenge. So the baseball theme runs throughout.
Okay. Do you, Benny, I'm sorry if I'm stepping on a question here. Have any, you told a story about when the idea popped into your head. There's been some things in the past. One of my favorite games to play as a kid was an old game for the Nintendo about dystopian. They had robots that played baseball, except it mixed baseball and combat. Like if there was a tie at the or a close call, the robots would fight and the winner got the base, you know, and you'd end up losing the game because you just ran out of players because your robots were getting beaten up. I see things like that. Was there anything that you think back in hindsight and you're like, maybe that inspired me? Or do you just kind of draw from real life and then, like you said, the creative mind?
I don't always know where it comes from, honestly. After a while, when you're a writer, sometimes you know, did this really ever happen? So I draw from inspiration in real life, and I just draw from the world. Once you build, what I did is I built a new world, as you know, and Benny read book one. I know he's reading book two now. So once you build a new world, you're obligated to follow the rules of that world. So your world builds upon itself. It's like a living organism. For example, in book one, one of the characters, in the war, America lost 17 million people, including 4 million children, okay? So in the novel, one of the main characters gets pregnant. So at first I thought, okay, well, she'll have an abortion. They said, wait a minute. In this world, abortion would be illegal because we have to rebreed. We have to replenish the stock. Children are revered. Mm-hmm. So, you know, as a writer, I had to follow the rules that I had not yet even created, but were logical. There are three most revered professions are cops, teachers, and doctors. So if I have brown hats that the detectives are called and blue shirts are the regular cops, if someone's investigating, they are mindful of rights. It's not like now where a cop could just throw you against the wall or break the law or go in a gray area, it's a very ethical society. So I had to follow that as well. So my inspiration begets my inspiration. And then also when your characters are interacting, and I know this sounds very precious, forgive me, but it's true. The characters take over as often as not and write the story. And damned if I know how. I don't think anyone has the slightest idea how this happens, but I'll start out writing a scene and say, are you kidding? I wouldn't do that. Mm-hmm. And I look, whoa, this is not at all what I planned, but it's pretty good. Thank you. Because again, you're developing characters who have their traits and they must behave a certain way. And you must follow that. So it's only after a while, that's the beauty. Once you get going, it's like rolling down a hill. Except for all the constant editing, because, you know, I do like 8-9 drafts and my books are 500 pages. So, yeah, you imagine. Yeah. You
right.
Can, yeah.
Well, as long as you don't pull a George R. R. Martin and wait 16 years to write the next one, you'd be set.
No, I'm good.
Benny, what you got?
So I'm going to segue back to July 1964. Yes. In Brooklyn, which is the setting for Joyland. And the first thing I saw was July 1964, and I'm thinking, well, I saw my first Major League Baseball game. I think it was August the 11th, 1964. I actually went to Shea Stadium and saw the Mets versus the Giants. It was a 14-inning game. But I think there was like five or six Hall of Famers game between the Mets and the Giants. But why did you choose Brooklyn and why did you choose that time period? And the first thing that struck me with that was the heavy duty, not racism, but the racial overtones of everything that was going on. So, I mean, you really picked a tough thing to write about.
Well, if it's not tough and it's not edgy and you're not pushing the envelope, then I don't think it's worth it. And my co-creator, Russell Friedman, and I, Russell grew up in Brooklyn. I grew up in the Bronx. And we both, we came of age. We were still, not quite of a level of high consciousness. We were still young. But the 60s was special because so much of today began then. And so much of today remains unresolved. And July 1964 starts. The series starts following riots after a cop killed an unarmed African-American teen. Well, hello. I mean, just too many things still happen. And we wanted to show what the 60s was like, the struggle for civil rights. And we wanted to set it in New York City. And I also believe that too often when you talk about civil rights, everything is set in the South and the North gets a pass. And that's nonsense. Because the North was, I grew up in a segregated white working class neighborhood, segregated. In the Bronx, there's the white neighborhood, there was the black neighborhood, there was the Hispanic neighborhood. That's how it was. For anyone to talk that it only happened in Mississippi, it's just not true. And, so we wanted to show that. We also wanted to show the class struggle, which often is not depicted. It's the little guys against the power establishment, which was really in control. And that's when everything started falling apart in the 60s, when you started challenging the man and said, well, wait a minute, why do things have to be the way they are? The clash of generations. So we wanted to go into that, but we wanted to do it through just regular folks. And one of our main characters is Marty Dent, a former Knicks player who wants to bring a basketball franchise to Brooklyn in the upcoming ABA. And his best friend is former Knicks teammate, African-American, Julian Bass, a reverend, Baptist minister, who's dealing with fighting for civil rights. And we look at we have very strong women in the show, I know Benny can attest, but this was before the women's movement. So for a woman to get a job, it was a big deal, like a job that maybe wasn't a teacher or a nurse or a secretary. So we lean into all that, and it's an ensemble. And we also... a part of the show is set in a bungalow colony in the Catskills. And for your listeners who don't know what that is, it was resourced for the summer, where working class, middle class, mainly Jews from New York came for 2 months so they didn't have the schvitz in the city. And so we look at it there. But the what makes it a little more dark is that the owner of that bungalow colony in our series, a white woman, has a relationship with a black man, which was, you know, in some places illegal. It's hard to believe it's illegal.
Right.
But remember 1964, okay. We talk about the problems, but there was also the hope that America was the greatest power in the world. We were locked in a death struggle with the Soviet Union. We had just stared them down over the Cuban Missile Crisis. We had the can-do spirit. Now, the can-do spirit didn't work in many areas. But in 1965, Lyndon Johnson proposed the Great Society, which was intended to eliminate poverty and end racial injustice. It didn't work. But you talk about a country which thought it could do that. And that's obviously what we no longer have. We don't have quite that hope, that idealism, that faith that we once had. But back then, we thought we could do it. We thought that segregation would be knocked down. And it didn't all work. And a lot of it went to hell. And of course, we went to Vietnam thinking, well, we'll just, you know, we'll stop those damn gooks and stop the commies. And, well, that didn't work either. But we thought we could because we were America. And so we want to lean into that, the balance between the hope of the world and our characters wanting to succeed and the fact that things are going to go wrong. And what's really cool is that we produced this on Zoom.
I was actually just about to ask, that's such a unique concept. What kind of challenges go into that?
Well, there's a lot of challenges. We thought, okay, now I know you're a geek, you're a Trekkie. Okay, so I'm going to tell you Kobayashi Maru. We want to
the unwinnable scenario.
Yes, we want to win. We want to change the way you develop a TV series. Why must it all go through the Hollywood elitist machine? Instead of people having to spend $1 million on a television pilot, what if you did something different like we're doing? And we've used Zoom, and the production values from episode 1 to 2 have been improved dramatically. And we've been able to bring people from actors from London to Los Angeles, Chicago, Florida, to participate in this wonderful voyage of ours. Gesundheit. Now,
thank you.
There are obvious challenges. I had to stop writing scenes where the characters went to kiss. Yeah, you can't do that. There's things you lose. You can't have, excuse me, that thematic shot. Because you can't, you can only show so much. And we have a brilliant director, Damone Serafin, who's an award-winning Broadway performer, and our technical producer and editor, Paul Lidwack, who is a complete genius. We do virtual backgrounds. So, for example, say the scene is Dan's living room. Okay, so we would say, okay, is Dan's middle class? So we would find virtual backgrounds that we would reflect the kind of furniture you would have. And then you and Benny's visiting you, so both of you have the same background.
Mm-hmm.
So we do things like that. But you can't have action. You can have very little physical action. And in episode 2, Damone decided we're doing away with stage directions. We did that in episode 1 because we weren't sure if the viewers would be able to follow the story unless we said, Benny goes to the window and or interior Dan's, right. You know, we were afraid that it would get lost. And we said, no, we're going to challenge everyone. We're going to challenge our actors to lean into it.
Okay.
And I think it really works. But so there are challenges, but then it's kind of like, oh, this is something really cool. And people have, after it dropped, episode 2 dropped yesterday, some people have said, wow, I didn't even think I was watching Zoom. So,
and I mean, like I said, visually, I haven't seen, excuse me, sorry, I haven't seen episode 2, but we're only going to upload the audio for the podcast. We're recording right now on video, looking at each other. I would never have envisioned, you know, oh, let's have, you know, the characters, instead of being in the same room talking, two faces on the screen with the same backgrounds. I know you do it with, like, you know, where they're at the bus stop and the church, you know, the, yeah, like you mentioned, the office, where the backgrounds are identical. It's really incredibly visually appealing. And something that's unique. I've never seen anything like it. So now we'll see what happens. You mentioned the Hollywood elite, having, yeah, to run, you know, doing something private. Hopefully you get to keep the idea, because anybody that's ever produced a student film or worked on a low budget project knows it doesn't take long before somebody swoops in and steals the idea, yeah, or runs with it. Yep. You know,
well, let them come and get us. That's what we're here for. Come and that's what we want. Come and get us. And,
there you go.
And what's fascinating, as you've seen from having watched it, is the chemistry the actors have, which, yeah, is a testament to their dedication. We just have an incredible cast. I mean, people who've been in, you know, television series and movies and on Broadway, and such talented people, but they've found a chemistry, even though we're all in boxes. It's kind of remarkable.
Right. Well, and I like the way you played it out with, like, having two characters, or if you have, you know, three or four, where you can space out the screen by, I don't want to say creates the illusion, but it does put your mind in a sense where I don't picture that I'm looking at three faces. I see three people sitting in a restaurant talking,
you know. Thank
it's incredible. I enjoy it. It's, anybody out there, we'll put a link when we upload the episodes. We'll put the links out on, it's episode 2 just came up on YouTube. Benny, you have a final question.
Real quick, Gary, how about your Black and White Cookie project? You want to talk about that real quick?
Yeah, Black and White Cookie was supposed to premiere in New York City Theater last March. You know, man plans, God laughs. We were canceled a week before by the pandemic, and so I've been zooming it out, and it's. It had Zoom productions in New York theater companies. In the UK, it just had one of the Jaggio Theater in Washington, D.C. And Sky Pilot Theater in Los Angeles is posting this Saturday. And Momenti Productions is doing a live YouTube performance on May 7th. So the hope is that once it lifts, that somewhere we can have live theater.
Great.
Yeah, I know Benny, we talked about this I believe both on the Bruno show and before, with wanting to go back to the wrestling matches. That's, I cannot, of any, everything I'm looking forward to live, everything I'm looking forward to, live events, live theater, live shows is definitely it.
Yeah.
So I mean, again, before we started recording, I gave the chatting up, and I said there's so much to cover, and I feel there's so much more we could talk about. So I would love in the future to have you back on the show.
As
Benny and I continue to move above and beyond and grow, hopefully when the next project comes around or new episodes are out, yeah, we could definitely have you back to talk more on that. And as the season goes on, we could even, you know, have a chat on wrestling and baseball. So, again, I appreciate it. Gary, do you have any social media or anything you want to plug on your way out?
Well, I'm on Twitter at Writer Gary, and on Facebook. And if you want to get the novels, you just go to Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Google Books, bookshop.org, wherever, or your local bookstore. They'll order it.
There you go. And anywhere books can be found, in your shows, like I said, we'll post a link to shows on YouTube. And incredible career, incredible story. Gary Borgenstein, thank you so much for being with us. You have a great night, and we'll definitely have to have you back.
Thank you, Bo. Thank you, Benny. Thank you, Dan. Take care.
Definitely our pleasure.
Take care, sir.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
You know, it's funny, you don't think much, Benny, about the transition, and you we talked about it in the beginning, starting with the wrestling magazines, and then here we are talking about everything from Zoom TV shows to dystopian baseball to Sharknado. It's incredible to see how the career can progress sometimes.
Definitely, you know, he's been involved in a lot of different things and done them all very well.
Yeah, and it's it's kind of a fun story because you've got somebody who, like he talked about, starting literally the let me try and scrape together an article, and here we are how many years later, and he's producing his own content and, you know, a big name in the writing industry, and I think that that's awesome.
I mean, and that's a first, somebody who actually really wasn't, you know, like me, you know, grew up idolizing Bruno. He, you know, he knew of Bruno, but he got really got involved in wrestling because it was his first job. It's just amazing.
Yeah. Well, and I liked the way he, when he was telling the story about the, when he was telling the story about having to write for, about Fritz Von Erich, where how much different it was writing in the territory days than what you and Javier and the other writers we've had through the show do, where he wrote an article that he knew wasn't going to be written. It wasn't going to be read by the Connecticut crowd. You know, you write an article on Fritz Von Erich, somebody in New Jersey probably has no idea who that is. Whereas, you know, you go on and write an article about Bruno, or Javier had one recently about the memorabilia. You're writing to a national audience, and it's funny to think about how things have changed, and really interesting how the challenges are different.
Now in my mind, though, because I got Newsday, we had Newsday delivered to our house. That was the newspaper that he found the ad in. And now I'm thinking, like, what if I had seen that ad? You know, I was 23 in 1978. What if I had seen that ad and written, you know, responded back? My whole life could have been different, but oh well.
Hey, you know, the world is always full of what ifs. You know, I mean, how many people have just on the episodes we've done? How many stories about chance meetings, or I forgot something and I had to run back in, and we ran into each other in the hotel or whatever? Yeah, it's life has a weird direction like that.
Absolutely.
But we continue to grow, and we continue to go, like I said, above and beyond. We're pushing right now the Facebook page at 500 fans, and that's not a bad run for what we've done. We talked about something, and I want to pitch the idea here to the fans. When we hit 500, we're going to put a post out on social media for questions, because we're going to do a special 500 Q&A, and then we'll go from there for 1,000 and keep going there. But yes, once we hit 500, we're any and every question, hypotheticals, facts you want to know about us, you want to talk wrestling, talk baseball, whatever. We'll put the post out when we hit 500. You and I, Benny, will do a special Q&A episode.
Well, and like the rabbi said right before he did the bris, it won't be long now.
Oh, Jesus. Because you're terrible.
We're at 494 members as we speak, so it literally could be the next day or two.
You're terrible. But
I pray for forgiveness every night.
Well, I mean, and we do have some plans coming up. Obviously, we're going to do our routine, the next pay-per-view that's coming out, the WrestleMania Part 2, as it seems like, or should I say Part 3, because WrestleMania was Saturday and Sunday. It looks like WrestleMania month now. And so I will admit, to go back to wrestling for a minute, the recent evolutions for both title matches, where on SmackDown it seems like Daniel Bryan, Cesaro, and Roman Reigns being involved, and then Raw just last night, like I said, we're recording this on a Tuesday, their title match main event is going to be a triple threat between Lashley, Braun Strowman, and Drew McIntyre. So I think both of those, both the Daniel Bryan's rematch and the triple threat, are great. They got a lot of stuff coming up, so we're going to have some fun talking about that show. We got plenty of wrestling news to discuss and some good guests coming out in the future. So, Benny, any parting thoughts?
No, just I'm having a blast. I want to thank everybody who contributes to our podcast page. We have quite a few people who actually post things, and we really appreciate that. And I've said it several times, I really appreciate how respectful everybody is. There, you know, you go to any wrestling page on Facebook, you look at any random post, and you just click on the thread, and I'll usually count, like, in my mind, like how many posts before it starts to deteriorate.
Yeah.
You know, where it gets disrespectful or ugly. And that doesn't happen with us.
Well, I mean, I just posted something the other day for casual conversation, asking our fans to share any opinions they might have that are unpopular or they feel are not commonly held in the wrestling business. I mean, that is, in hindsight, an invitation for argument and debate, and everybody's been great about agreeing peacefully or disagreeing or how the good conversations this has led to. We definitely, I mean, when Jeff, my predecessor, when he started everything, he called it the little podcast that could, and we're chugging along with the good fan base that could. So
yes.
Obviously we continue to grow. We can be found anywhere podcasts are listened to. Dan and Benny in the Ring on Facebook. So for, again, we thank everybody for the BS Express himself. I'm Dan Sebastiano. You have a good night. And as always, happy wrestling.
Night, folks.